Choke points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. This is what we call a lightning round, where I pepper Chris with transportation questions. Are you ready?
Yes. Yes, I am.
All right,
you
got to
put time on the clock?
Yes, in fact. Okay, here we go. We're going to start with an update on last week's Battery Street Tunnel choke point. Did you make a mistake?
Yes, I did. I said that the Battery Street Tunnel would also be closing at the same time as the Alaskan Way Viaduct, basically January 11th. And that's not the case. The Battery Street Tunnel is going to remain open during that 3 weeks of closure. You'll be able to get off and on at Western. Mm-hmm. But from that point, that's as far as you can go. But you will still be able to use the Battery Street Tunnel. The folks at the DOT hooked me up over the weekend and said, hey, Chris, can you get an update on that? And I'm like, okay, I made a mistake. It'll be open a little bit longer than I had said.
But eventually it still is going to be filled in.
Yes, it is still going to be filled in. That has not changed.
Okay, listener Brian asked about the new HOV ramp in Renton and who gets to use it.
Yeah, so basically
this is that giant flyover.
Yeah, it's getting pretty close to opening. It's looking really good. And it is going to open sometime in the middle of next year. And it is going to open before we start the widening project there between Renton and Bellevue. And it's going to function just like a typical HOV ramp, just like the current conditions on 405. From 5A to 7P, it's going to be HOV only. And then after those hours, it'll be open to everybody to use it. And again, keep in mind, once we expand the widening of 405 all the way up to Bellevue, it's going to become an express toll lane flyover ramp as well. So that's going to be into the mix, but it'll keep the same configuration as we have on 405 currently with the express toll lanes, in that they will be free from 7P to 5A.
So that will eventually be connected to the entire express toll lane system?
Yes. So eventually what we're going to have is an express toll lane system that goes from Linwood all the way down south of Auburn there through 405 and 167. And,
so they're adding another lane to 405 in
this
direction?
Yes, they are. So it's going to be a two-lane express toll lane, just like we have from the Bothell area down to Bellevue. It's going to continue now from Bellevue down
just
to Renton.
Just by striping, or are they going to add pavement?
They're going to add pavement, and believe me, through the S-curves, there's not a lot of wiggle room in there to do what they're going to do, but they are going to squeeze another lane out of that, and it's going to be an express toll lane system.
Okay, listener, Gary Compton asked when the city of Seattle is going to finish the 4th Avenue South Bridge project in Georgetown.
Yeah, this is the bridge that goes over the railroad tracks and leads you right up to the big Costco there, kind of in the Soto area. For a year now, they've had the right lane blocked because they found some cracks on the bridge. And that project was supposed to be wrapped up in November, like a month ago. And so he's like, what's the deal? When are they going to finish this thing? And I went to the city, and it turns out it could be blocked for another year.
Why?
It could be double the time. Apparently, what they found is the cracking in that bridge is a little bit more extensive than they thought. And they've also had a hard time working with BNSF finding the ability to work above the railroad tracks, because that's the huge spur area in there where there's a lot of track, and they're finding it very difficult to find opportune times to actually get the work done. So that's not going to be done for a while. So that's double the expected closure time than they were billed when they closed that lane in October of 2017.
Okay, the answer is then you've got to live with that for a while longer.
Yeah, you do.
Listener Michael Welch asked you to check out some holes being dug in Lake City.
Yeah, he was concerned, and really he was like, they're putting in tolling. I know they're putting in tolling. Go check this thing out, because there are two giant tubes that were built, like dug into the ground. And so these giant, like 5-foot circumference ballpark on either side of 125th there in Lake City, right as it kind of goes towards Sand Point and kind of starts taking that right-hand turn down Lake Washington there. And so I went out and I checked it out. Now, yeah, there are two giant tubes built into the ground, but it's part of the Safe Streets program. They're putting in a flashing beacon crosswalk there to help the kids get across 125th a lot easier. So that's it's not tolling. It's not nefarious. It's there. They're putting a crosswalk in there to help the kids. Everybody's automatically, they see any construction, they're not sure. It's tolling.
We're so paranoid.
So right now, no, that's for safe streets for the kids to get across 125th.
Yeah, the idea that tolling is going to expand is just crazy. We keep getting questions about the rules on the double white lines in the 405 tolling lanes. So you want to settle that once and for all?
Yeah, just once and for all. The people keep asking me, when a toll is free, so from 7P to 5AM, when the express toll lanes are technically off, they want to know if the double white line applies. And the answer is yes.
Yes.
24/7, a double white line is a double white line.
And the reason for that is safety, right?
Completely. Yeah, completely. They want, it's, instead of putting barrier up to differentiate those lanes, they dub double white line. Now, you're not, there's no laser there that's going to blow out your tires when you cross. That would probably be good, considering how many violations we know. That's terrible. But it's a safety thing, and they are 24/7. A double white line is always a double white line, regardless of when those express toll lanes are on or off.
Okay, and finally, so far you've gotten all these right, Chris, amazingly.
as far as you know, yes.
Another question about school buses. Trace wants to know why drivers stop for them on five-lane roads.
Yes, he saw something that I see quite frequently on 132nd in Everett. You have a five-lane road with a turn lane, even a barrier in the middle. And he says, and I have seen, people who stop in the opposite direction for a bus on a five-lane road, a school bus with its flashers on.
Well, even I know you're not supposed to.
You don't have to do that. You don't do that. There's no reason to do that. And it's kind of the herd mentality. Everyone, well, somebody stops and they're like, oh, maybe I'm supposed to stop.
Well, they're so scared because the buses have cameras now.
Yeah, and so we just go from that. And what we're looking at is the rule is three lanes or more, you do not have to stop in the opposite direction.
Very good, Chris. Thank you.
All right. My pleasure, Dave.
Just weeks after voters rejected a carbon fee, Governor Inslee is rolling out his clean energy smart deal. Car Radio's Hannah Scott has the story.
The governor was all smiles yesterday as he detailed the package of legislative proposals that he described as a noble cause, targeting everything from coal power to fuel standards.
It is a noble cause to fight for our children's health. It is a noble cause to fight for a clean energy economic development plan. It is a noble cause to see to it that Washington State will fulfill its destiny to lead the clean energy revolution in the world today.
Inslee says the package will allow us to meet goals currently in state law to cut greenhouse gases in Washington to 25% under 1990 levels by 2035. The ambitious package would eliminate fossil fuels such as natural gas and coal from the state's electricity supply by 2045, requiring utilities to provide carbon-free electricity by then. The plan also calls for incentives to boost the use of electric vehicles, a clean fuel standard similar to California's to target auto emissions, and more energy efficiency regulations for buildings. It would also phase out so-called superpollutant hydrofluorocarbons used for refrigeration and air conditioning. The governor has included $268 million in his proposed two-year budget for clean energy proposals. Of that, $53 million would go to convert two state ferries, the Puyallup and Wenatchee Jumbos, to hybrid power, replacing two of their four diesel engines with batteries. Another $64 million would be used to build two new electric ferries. Not included in the ambitious plan? A carbon tax or fee. But Inslee's not ruling it out.
When you propose a package, it doesn't presuppose not doing some other package. This is the package we believe that fits our ability to pass legislation this year. I'm not ruling out anything else in the next decade or so. This is what we're doing today.
The governor also acknowledged the fact that voters rejected the carbon tax, describing this as a plan B. He believes he can get through the legislature. And he may be right. Democrats made significant gains in the legislature this past session in both the House and the Senate to grow their majorities. But Inslee is still expected to face some tough opposition from Republicans like Senator Doug Erickson, who says these proposals are just a tax in disguise because they will lead to higher energy costs for taxpayers.
Governor Inslee has absolutely no mechanism to be able to lower carbon emissions to 25% below any year level. That's going to come through innovation in the private sector and by the government working with industry groups. There's a better pathway forward. I'm hopeful Governor Inslee will start to embrace that. Unfortunately, he's sending every indication that he's going to use this new energy tax proposal as some type of his potential springboard to national prominence and his run for the presidency.
And there's no obvious tax in the governor's proposal, but he was vague when asked about the higher energy costs for taxpayers.
I think that it will avoid enormous costs that a path of inaction would take. We got to understand our choice in Washington State. The choice is between inaction and action. The costs of inaction are enormous.
As for whether this is about the governor's potential run for the White House in 2020?
I don't think anybody who cares about their children cares about anybody's electoral prospects. I think they care about a state where you don't wake up in the morning and there's ash on the hood of your car because the forests are all burning down.
Hannah joins us now. She's headed south. So is the governor claiming that by doing this, Washington State alone can change the path of ever-rising temperatures?
Well, certainly not globally, but it's a step that gets us in line with the Paris Accord, which, you know, the Trump administration has backed out of. So that's what the governor has long said, that he will make Washington State follow those proposals. And this is a step in that direction. And he made clear that there are going to be more steps needed. But this is a big step that he wants to get and that will dramatically cut our state's emissions, he said, within the next 15 years and put us in line. Already in state law, there's a goal to get that, I believe it's 25% under the 1990 levels. This gets us there, he says.
Well, I mean, everybody is in support of clean energy, but the idea that if you build, you know, a couple of electric ferries, that it's going to change the wildfire problem. I mean, what changes the wildfire problem is proper forest management, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and absolutely, and I'm sure that's what the DNR would tell you. And I think he pointed in this press conference yesterday to a couple of different studies. One was the recent federal study that kind of linked forest fires in California to global warming. Also, I think, said some things about our salmon population suffering and agricultural jobs. Then he also pointed to the recent study that came out after that, that I believe the UW took part in, that said we are on path, as far as global warming goes, to we're kind of in line with what was coming right ahead of the mass extinction event more than 250 right. million years ago, known as the Great Dying. So he's trying to do all he can. Again, though, we're not seeing a lot as far as what this might mean for taxes or higher energy costs. Yeah. I know the clean fuel standard that California has done has raised their gas prices like 3 to 6 cents. So it remains to be seen what it will do here.
Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Denise Juneau is Seattle's new school superintendent. She's been on a listening tour. She is living proof that an English major can find productive work. I want to congratulate you on that. Also, it doesn't hurt to get a law degree and to have gone to Harvard for your degree in education. So I won't read the whole resume, but welcome. It's good to meet you.
Thank you.
Let's talk about racial equity, because that's one of the things that came up during your extensive listening tour.
Yeah.
And it's something that we've been working on since at least, 1954.
Right.
So what will you do that's new?
Well, so through the listening and learning tour, something that drew me to Seattle actually for this job was during the interview process, people weren't afraid to talk about racial equity and at least say the words, and it doesn't happen like that all across the country. And so that was exciting. And then since I've been here and the listening and learning tour just really strengthened, one thing that I think we really need to get serious. There's been a lot of work done at the district and across the city with families around trying to figure out what is it exactly. And when we look at data, we know exactly what it is. It's a huge opportunity gap between white students and students of color that we really need to dig in and get real about and figure out how we're going to better serve. You know, Seattle is actually a high-performing district in the country when you look at test scores and graduation rates, but we have the significant challenges of trying to close the gap between white students and students of color.
And pockets of schools where perhaps that growth or that opportunity hasn't quite reached those students. So high performing as a whole, but pockets of schools where the inequity is pretty obvious. And is that why Seattle Public Schools is going after two levies?
Well, that's in part of the issue. So the two levies, one of them is really about buildings. There are certain school buildings in the city that really need to be rebuilt. And so we have 8 of those schools. And then the next part of that is looking at safety across the district, you know, making sure that there are the front doors have security systems, that we're looking at earthquake issues, and making sure that our structures that students learn in are good and safe places for them to be. And then the second one is the operations levy. And that really is to, like, for example, it's to fill gaps in where the state is currently not providing funding. And so, for example, the state gives the school funding for 9 nurses. We employ and need 63.
Oh.
And so the levy helps us fill that in. What the state also does not fully fund special education. And so about $60 million of the fund of the levy that is up for renewal actually helps us backfill some of those services as well. And so it's critical needs across the district. But of course, we know that the resources sometimes need to be distributed equitably in areas that need it more.
But racial equity is about more than just resources, isn't it? It's about expectations. It's about something as simple as detention policy. So how do you go about addressing those issues?
So as I've been stepping into this role, I've looking at all kinds of different equity issues and things just as simple as field trips.
Field trips.
And so there are some schools that can raise a lot of money through PTAs that allow students to have access to go places and take groups of students and do field trips. And then there are some schools that don't have those types of resources that don't get to go. And so we have examples of some schools that are able to take their bands and their orchestras on 8 to 12 trips a year, and some schools that get to go on one. And so even looking across the district, not even just academics, there are all these issues that we just need to continually raise the issue.
And as you're etching away with these umbrella projects like racial equity and bringing opportunity and something as simple as field trips to most schools, you still have the day-to-day issues that are cropping up. One of those, the school bus emergency, which was supposed to be solved and wrapped up by October and yet continues. I think I had just read in the Seattle Times that Seattle Public Schools just renewed that emergency plan.
Yep.
So how are we getting kids to school consistently and on time?
Right. And as I've been traveling around the city, one of my issues, and I've been talking to community members, is like, I am apologizing for not delivering students. You know, for us as a district to say it's important for your student to be in school, and then for us to be failing on delivering students to school in a timely way, we need to change that. And the biggest issue is the lack of bus drivers. They're part-time, low-paying jobs. And so the fact that I cannot solve a bus driver shortage. Our contractor doesn't seem to be able to solve a bus driver shortage. And so those routes get missed. We've had to add in another contractor now to help backfill some of that. But I want to bring together a think tank. I mean, Seattle, when I look at it, is full of not just money, but brain power and people who have thought through these big issues. And I want to bring together a group of people who can help me think through how we deliver students differently next year. Yellow school buses make sense where I come from in Montana when you have to go long distances and pick up kids along the way. They don't make sense here in Seattle in such a congested urban area where it's hard to get around. We can't find the drivers that are necessary to fill all the routes. And so we need to sort of figure out how to disrupt the system and do it differently within Seattle Public Schools. And so that's where I want to move, is sort of bring these people together. Let's think it through. Let's look at some urban planning, transportation routes, and how are we going to do it differently next year? Because it's one of my top priorities that I need to fix this year.
Do you anticipate this school bus shortage issue to continue throughout the entire school year?
Well, I don't see any near way to fix it, given it's a driver shortage. And it's not just Seattle. This is nationwide. I've talked to other urban school superintendents who are struggling with the same issues of driver shortage, congestion in cities, trying to get around. And so it is something that's really ripe for thinking about differently. And so I look forward to those conversations moving forward.
I'm curious, why would you want a job like this?
Well,
given
that
the typical school superintendent always seems to leave under a cloud of some kind. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, there's always hope in public education. I'm in public education. You know, I have a long history of involvement in public education. My family's been in public education. I grew up on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation. And so I've seen what public education can do for individuals, for communities, and it's powerful. And so anytime I can step into a leadership role and help provide the values of public education, the importance of it, and do what I can to make sure that we are closing those opportunity gaps, do what I can to make sure that every student is provided a quality education, doing what I can so that families feel involved, doing what I can so that students graduate and have the skills to be able to step into the next phase of their life. I want to be a part of that. It's why I ran for state superintendent in Montana. And what excited me about this job, again, I think, is because Seattle was talking about the right issues. They were talking about the right values. And because of the power of money in this city, brain power, personality, if we can harness that and make sure we're focusing on the right issues, we are going to be a world-class education system.
Denise Juneau is the Seattle School District Superintendent, and you'll be hearing a lot more from her as that levy comes closer.
Yes, that's for sure. Thank you so much.
Time for your Daily Dose of Kindness. It's brought to you by Spring Free Trampoline. Troops stationed in Afghanistan, Japan, and Germany will receive care packages this holiday season, thanks to a family in Wisconsin. And CBS's Aaron Taylor has their story.
The owners of Dries Transportation are loading up a different kind of shipment.
All week we've been packaging them up. Socks, foot powder, candy. A lot of small items.
Gifts for the troops in honor of a care package this family never got the chance to send.
My son was killed in Afghanistan in 2009. We were sending packages to him, but before we could even get them shipped out, he was killed.
Those packages were eventually delivered.
And we sent them to his unit, and from there we decided to send them to whatever area names we got. It seemed like the right thing to do.
Stephen would never receive a care package from his family, but hundreds of others have.
We've done this for 9 years now. I wish I had a count of how many we've sent. It's a lot. This, I believe, is one of the biggest shipments we've sent.
98 packages in honor of one life lost too soon.
Keep Stephen's memory going.
That's CBS's Aaron Taylor.
Wow. Well, at least, I mean, talk about profound sadness, right?
You know.
But to do something positive out of it.
And turning that energy and trying to affect other people's, I mean, you see it time and time again, that grace and that recovery and grief to make other people's lives better is truly a something.
It's time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, the Shakespeare of Sports, Danny O'Neill. Describing those touchdowns as exclamation points was the perfect metaphor. And the Vikings' final touchdown was sort of like a typo. And everything else is defense.
It was meaningless scoring. It's a weird game. Yeah. You had 3 points. What, 6 points were scored for the first 57 minutes. And then you had 22 points scored in the final 3 minutes. Yet none of those final 22 points really decided the outcome. Like, it was pretty much assuring things that would happen. It was a strange game, and one that the Seahawks should be pretty darn proud of because their defense played really well. That was as impressive a defensive performance as you're going to see from an NFL team.
And thank goodness, too, because Russell Wilson didn't have a great game.
No.
And my question to you is because I saw that scramble where we were at, like, the 1 or 2 yard line. We were about to score, and he was great. He slipped, and that's when he sort of flipped the ball. Is that a uniquely Russell Wilson quarterback thing, or do all quarterbacks do that? I just feel like he slips up and hesitates so much.
He definitely scrambles more than other quarterbacks do.
Okay.
He should have, the moment he slipped, he should have stood up and threw the ball out of bounds because they would have had time for one more play, and then they could have kicked a field goal. And instead, when he turned around and created, now, he's had other moments where there was a playoff game against Minnesota when the ball was snapped over his head and he wasn't ready. And in fact, he had his mouthpiece in his hand, and he stopped to put the mouthpiece in as he chased back to go then pick up the ball, scoop it up, then turn around and throw it down. Like, it was just ridiculous that he had that kind of composure. So that same thought process of, I can still make something out of this, even though I've slipped and fallen, led him to make a terrible decision, which was to turn back into the play. And then he's going to get sacked. And as he's going down, as he's going to get sacked, he knows, if I get sacked here, we're probably not going to get another playoff. The half's
That's
probably going
to
get...
That's why he was trying to avoid the sack. Because I thought, just take the sack, man.
Right. Well, if you're going to throw an interception, that's the best time to throw it.
Well, yeah. Here's the problem is that he got lucky because the linebacker didn't catch it cleanly.
Yeah.
If he does, now it's a linebacker. I think somebody runs him down. But it would have been close, and if that's a DB, he's gone. That's 7 points that you've just given.
Well, we got a couple breaks there. There was a pass interference call that went our way that didn't look like pass interference to me at all.
Looked like they might have got the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
Looked like he might have been what they call hand fighting. At the same time, the DB hadn't turned around. The big one was the blocked field goal.
Yeah.
So have you
now,
seen...
Now, is that legal? I mean, that happened before in a game, right, where somebody jumps over the top. Isn't
that was Bam Cam, right?
Cam did it in a playoff game against Carolina, and then Bobby Wagner did it in a game against Arizona, the game that they tied back in 2016. So it's allowed. They've changed the rules now. You can't take a running start. You have to be standing still, which he was. Uh-huh. What you can't do is you can't put your hands on your teammate as you jump.
On your teammate.
Or the opponent. You can't.
Or the opponent.
It's called leverage.
You can't use him as a springboard, basically.
Correct.
Because it kind of looked like he did that.
Yes, he did. He had his hands on. He touched the backs of two of his teammates as he jumped across the line of scrimmage, which is a foul.
You can't do that.
Should have been a penalty. But here's what happens. You play the Seahawks on Monday night. Weird stuff's going to happen with the officiating. We had Golden Tate with the touchdown catch. You had KJ Wright with
the
KJ Wright with the batting the ball out of the end zone, and that should have been a penalty, and it wasn't called. So yeah,
let's talk about that fight last night, though.
The scrap between the guys where the flag was thrown.
Yeah, and the guy who wasn't even involved got the penalty.
Yeah,
that's right.
Now they corrected it and said, "Oh, it was on Simmons." Also, might have been on 65 because it looked like he might have brushed a ref, like as he was sticking his hand out. So it might have been.
I didn't see that on the replay.
I'm not sure. They should have let it go. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Seattle's got a very feisty offensive line.
Yeah.
So the officials had probably already warned them, like, we don't want any of that stuff.
Sure.
Or, they could have let that go.
Explain to us why it was such a big deal that George Fant caught a pass.
Because he's an offensive lineman, and it's awesome when
big
guys catch passes.
But he used to be a wide
passes.
Receiver, right?
He was a tight end kind of in college. Oh. He's never caught a pass in the NFL, though. He almost scored. Did you see that?
Yeah. Except he slipped.
Yeah, he slipped and probably would have been tackled by all other 11 players on the defense had he not slipped. But it was really exciting for a moment. No, that was great. Everybody got. You see how pumped up everyone got when George Fant caught a pass?
Yeah. And by the way, we haven't even discussed Chris Carson. Are we just taking him for granted now? I thought he had some pretty great runs. And in some cases, he ran 80 yards to get 14, but he did it.
He's got to do some explaining to his mom, too. He jumped over another guy. He's not supposed to do that anymore. His mom doesn't like it when he jumps over people.
His mom told him not to?
Yeah, because you remember the last time when he flipped over?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
The and landed flip. And did the superhero land. His mom was like, don't do that anymore.
Have you ever watched a football game with the mom of a professional athlete?
No,
That would be fun.
Yeah, it would.
And terrifying.
Yeah.
You know?
It would be interesting. Like, what? I've talked to Wyman about that before, and he's talked about that the one thing he always tried to get up, even when he was hurt, and Wyman was hurt a lot in his career, because he knew his mom was watching, and he didn't want her to think that he was seriously injured. He wanted her to know he was okay.
That's so sweet.
Yeah, but yeah, that's a great story idea.
And yesterday you said that if the Seahawks won last night, they were going to the playoffs.
Yes. It's a virtual certainty at this point. If they win one more, it's clinched. Their chances of going to the playoffs are now greater than 99%. Yeah, it's all but wrapped up. It's not even a matter of controlling their own destiny.
Okay,
they're a
lead
pipe cinch.
It's accountability time, though. Although you did predict a win.
What's the score going to be?
Oh, this is pressure now. The Seattle Seahawks are going to score 33 points, and the Minnesota Vikings are going to have 24.
Okay.
Neither team got to 24, did they?
No. Neither team got to 24.
No.
So,
was the point spread at least close?
No, not really. I said 9, and they won by 14.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
sorry,
there's really nothing that was correct about that prediction.
Here's the thing, though. In the overall scheme of the prediction business, that was pretty good. I got the right team winning
by
a significantly large margin. It just didn't happen anyway close to
the way
actually,
it was
the
Hawks that screwed up because they should have won by that score.
No, I don't know. Did you watch how Russell Wilson played? He threw for 72 yards.
Yeah.
That's definitely the more you predict, the more you're going to show you're behind. That's the moral of the story.
Anyway, win's a win.
That's exactly right.
Yep. Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. The World Health Organization recently reported an alarming spike in the number of measles cases worldwide and here in the U.S. So why are we still seeing vaccine-preventable diseases, even here in the U.S.? Kyria's Heather Bosch reports it's partly because of a small group of parents willing to put their kids at risk.
It's a concerning trend.
Unfortunately, in the last 2 years, we have seen a worrying uptick in the number of measles cases.
Martin Frieda with the World Health Organization blames a lack of vaccinations, particularly in parts of the world where healthcare is tough to access. In fact, health experts suspect it was a foreign traveler who likely started a measles outbreak at a California amusement park in 2015. But a spike in measles cases in the U.S. in 2017 stemmed largely from a community in Minnesota who skipped vaccines on purpose over concern. concerns about autism.
I'll be abundantly clear on this. There have been numerous excellent randomized control trials. Those are kind of our gold standard studies out there that do not show any connection whatsoever between autism and any vaccine, including the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine.
John Lynch is an infectious disease doctor at Harborview and UW Medicine. You also can't catch a disease from a vaccination itself. Vaccines contain only dead or inert forms of the illness that teach your immune cells to recognize and remember the disease. Dr. Robert Klemm with Swedish Medical.
And these memory cells just sort of stay in the background. And then if you're exposed to, say, the flu virus or something like that, your body can now mount a really large immune response because it's seen this before.
So why do you sometimes feel crummy after a shot? Klemm says it's your immune system being triggered.
So you may get a few swollen glands, you may feel a little fatigued, a little punky, maybe even a low-grade fever, but that's just your body's immune system sort of getting activated.
It's true if you catch diseases like chickenpox or measles, your body will also develop an immunity. But Frieda says it's not worth the risk.
A lot of people have forgotten how dangerous measles can be. It is one of the leading causes of blindness. It can also cause pneumonia, and it can cause severe cerebral deficiencies.
Doctors say vaccines don't prevent illness 100% of the time, but if you do get a disease, it will likely be much less severe than without the protective vaccine. And when you're vaccinated, it actually protects others.
Kind of what we call the herd immunity. And it takes a fairly large percentage, probably about 80%, if not greater, of a community to be immunized to prevent that illness from sort of penetrating into the community, and particularly to try and protect those that are most vulnerable. The oldest, you know, geriatric populations or those that have multiple chronic disease, or really the youngest babies and infants.
That's key. The Washington State Department of Health says vaccination rates among kindergartners are consistently in the mid to high 80s, so outbreaks here are not common but can still happen. Experts say it would take a 95% vaccination rate to eradicate measles, for instance, just as smallpox was eliminated in 1980. As a mom, Melissa Genualdi vaccinates her young children. As a doctor with Swedish Medical, she's talked with parents who might believe the myths about vaccines.
Most people have reasons why, and once you find out why, you can help educate them, give them some resources. There's lots of false claims out there with vaccines, and there's lots of different beliefs and what parents think. And so I think just finding out why and then educating them.
There's Heather Bosch. Among your millennial cohort, are there parents who were resistant to vaccines?
I don't think it's just millennials either. I think there's Gen Xers as well who are resistant. And I think I can't tell you why. I think part of it has to do with a lot of these diseases. Varicella, chickenpox being one of them. I remember I've going, isn't that a rite of passage in childhood? Mm-hmm. But I had to change my mind about that. And I had to go, yeah, well, if I can prevent my child from that discomfort, why wouldn't I? Especially when all evidence points to these vaccines are safe and no, they do not cause autism. I think that's highly offensive to parents of children on the autism spectrum as well. This idea that because you vaccinated your child, you caused this to happen to them. For me, it's just irresponsible not to make that choice to support modern medicine and vaccinate your children. You know, here I am about to have another child in May. I can't imagine losing that child because a parent decided not to believe evidence.
I know my generation, since we saw those diseases, we saw chickenpox, we certainly saw measles and mumps. You don't want your child to get that.
No.
And maybe that's the problem. We've lost that firsthand memory of what this used to be like. I mean, and actually, when I was growing up, polio was an epidemic.
Mm-hmm. And I have to remind people, herd immunity, that's what it's about. Vaccines are not about you. It's about everyone else. You are vaccinating yourself to protect the larger community. That's herd immunity. So babies, the elderly, those with compromised immune systems, cancer patients, you are getting vaccinated not just for yourself, but for the community as a whole.
Right. Makes sense. Let's go to Washington, D.C., Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Farenthold. David, government shutdown in 11 days, and the debate is always, who do we blame for it? Explain why, if the Republicans still have majorities in both the House and Senate and they don't want to shut the government down, why can't they keep it open?
The border wall. There's been a lot of demands by President Trump to add a whole bunch of money for his proposed border wall, which is, as you recall, he said Mexico would pay for. Some in his own party have resisted that. That's been the subtext of every sort of shutdown threat over the last couple of years of unified Republican control. It's never actually happened. I think even though the dynamics have changed a little bit, I don't think it's going to happen this time either. A shutdown, I mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, does it require 60 votes in the Senate? Because that would require Democrats too, right?
Well, this particular one would not require 60 votes in the Senate, but I think there are some Republicans who wouldn't go along with it. Certainly the Republican majority is only two, and so they need some Democrats to go. They would need Democrats if any Republicans defected.
Okay. The other discussion, of course, is the impact of these three sentencing memos that have been issued by various prosecutors. And I saw a headline this morning saying, quoting people close to Trump, saying the president is now concerned about impeachment. Do you know anything about that?
I feel like we've seen versions of that headline a lot over the last couple of years, or certainly over the last year. These filings made it obvious, especially the ones concerning Michael Cohen, Trump's longtime lawyer, make it clear that even if you put the Russia probe aside, and we don't really know where that is going yet, when it relates to Trump, even if you put that aside, just the Stormy Daniels case, just arranging for Michael Cohen to make payments for the silence of this woman who claimed to have had sex with Donald Trump, the clear implication from those sentencing documents was that Trump, by ordering that, had broken campaign finance laws. Michael Cohen is pleading guilty to being a part of that conspiracy, and Trump is clearly implicated as somebody who was also involved in it. So even if you put Russia aside, Trump is in some serious legal trouble there. Now, whether that means he personally gets charged or indicted, I think that's unlikely given the Justice Department's guidance. But I think that Cohen filing shows you how close that totally separate from Russia case has come to Trump.
And legal trouble, because Rand Paul was saying, what's the big deal if a private citizen, and he was in 2016 a private citizen, wants to build a hotel in Moscow?
Well, that private citizen is running for president, and actually at the point Trump was still continuing to talk about Trump Moscow, was the Republican nominee for president. That's someone that you have to reasonably project could become president and should themselves, they're obviously thinking about what they'd do as president. If that person is reaching out, as we now know he did, is reaching out to the government of Russia. Now, remember, this wasn't just to some investor in Russia, some business person. Michael Cohen called the Kremlin and spoke to somebody who worked for the Russian government to seek Vladimir Putin's help in getting this deal. If you're making that kind of outreach to another government, asking them for a private favor, that matters a lot if that person has a good chance of becoming the next president.
Right. But just to be curmudgeonly here, every company, for example, that does business in China has to work with the Chinese government because they own half of every company.
Sure. But people that are in the middle of asking another country for a favor, if that person runs for president, we should understand that because it means we should reframe our understanding of their, in this case, Donald Trump's outreach to Russia with that in mind, that this is not just a public policy, position he's taken. This is somebody he needs a personal favor from to make, according to the filing, more than $100 million.
Okay, but I mean, is the law written to say that once you become merely a candidate for president, which really doesn't require anything else but, setting up a campaign committee and going on TV a lot, the law applies differently to you?
I guess there's two separate issues here. There's a legal issue that involves Michael Cohen's paying off Stormy Daniels, and there it seems clear that what Michael Cohen did was illegal, and he did it with Trump. The Russia question that Rand Paul's talking about, I don't think people are asserting that was illegal, that there was a law that Trump broke. Mm-hmm. There might have been a law broken if they really did offer Putin himself a penthouse in the building. There's a law against bribing people in foreign governments. But I don't think people believe that the outreach to Russia by Michael Cohen was illegal, but it certainly was something that matters a lot to our understanding of Trump as a presidential candidate and as a president.
Well, even on the Stormy Daniels thing, for example, is the illegality there the fact that the voters deserved to know about these allegations, which he considers to have been false, or was it the shell game that Michael Cohen used for the payoff?
Basically, these were campaign expenditures. This was money spent in the furtherance of Donald Trump's campaign, and it was not listed as such in campaign finance documents. It was concealed as a payment on behalf of the campaign and to help the campaign. I think my understanding of campaign finance law is not the greatest in the world, but it was not the fact that the payment was made. It's the fact that the payment was concealed.
That the payment was concealed. Because I was looking back to find out when the story came out, and the story came out on The Smoking Gun on October 18th, 2016, so about like 3 weeks before the election. So presumably anybody who wanted to inform themselves about President Trump's indiscretions had access to the information.
Yeah, it's not that they conspired to hide the fact that President Trump was allegedly had sex with this woman. It's that they paid her off in furtherance of the campaign. It didn't describe it and list it and disclose it as a campaign finance payment.
Right. David Farenthold, Washington Post. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.